From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's sports show, Only a Game. As a child, NBA veteran Caron Butler never expected to make it out of his hometown. Ahead on Only a Game, Butler tells the story of his unlikely escape from a life of selling drugs and dodging bullets. Also, the New York Liberty's historic season has some holding their noses. A Syrian soccer coach finds refuge in Spain, and I remember the time when Yankees great Yogi Berra dropped in for a visit. Also ahead, NASCAR legend Jeff Gordon will retire after this season, and he tells me what he'll miss most.
There's nothing greater than experiencing victory, but it's all the hard work and the people that contributed to it. You get that checkered flag and celebrate that together as a team. It's hard to top that.
Stay tuned. Next month, Caron Butler will begin his 14th season in the NBA, playing for the Sacramento Kings. As a child, Butler didn't dream of becoming a professional basketball player. In fact, he didn't have many hopes for his future at all. He told us his story in his own words.
I used to always respect these people that came and reached out and took time out their life, their busy life, to talk to me and try to influence and encourage me to do positive things. But at the same time, you did not experience what I experienced. You do not see what I see every time I jump off the porch and I live my life on a day-to-day. Have you ever lost your best friend? Have you ever been shot at? Have you ever shot at someone? Do you know how we feel about you? And do you know how they feel about me? I grew up in Racine, Wisconsin. You know, everybody was a little hard on for cash, but everyone made ends meet. I had role models. Wasn't positive role models. People that wore flashy jewelry and gold chains and drove around in fancy cars and had the women and, you know, sold drugs. My mom, you know, even when she wasn't working in the shift she's supposed to be sleeping, she still was up, raising me, my baby brother as well, working hard, relentlessly, two jobs, and to this day, I still don't know how she did it. I had a paper out, you know, I try to make ends meet, try to buy the newest shoes and the newest outfits and stuff like that so I can be fresh, but I just felt like the paper out wasn't enough. I started selling drugs. I was easy 11 or 12 years old. I picked up my first pack. I was out in the streets and making moves, making sales, trying to build my clientele, make my mark, and, you know, get as much money as fast as I can. People was dying, you know, so often, and it was, you know, shootouts even more often. So, you know, you had to protect yourself. I grew up in, you know, dare and hang tough and take a bite out of crime and all that too. But at the same time, this is what my future holds anyway. Like, I don't see anything outside of this. And the people that I do see that's working are working extremely hard, like my mother's working. So I took the risk. I was always taller than the other kids. I still stand at about 6'6", 6'7". I've been this height since probably about 9th grade, 8th grade. You know, basketball was just, you know, a pastime. I didn't look years down the road. I was just trying to survive that minute, that next hour, that next second. Like, I didn't look to the future like that. I remember that morning arriving to Case High School, and I saw the ATF come in the classroom, and I looked around, and, you know, we had the windows that kind of didn't slide all the way open, so I couldn't jump out or anything. We was on the second floor. You know, they apprehended me, they handcuffed me, and they told me that they had found a gun in the locker and some cocaine as well. You know, a lot of times before, it was more hearsay. But this time, I was caught red-handed with everything, and I was just stuck. I ended up in Ethan Allen, correctional facility, I went to the hole. It humbled me. You know how you can just be humbled and just continue to be humbled before you just finally get the message? Because people always say, like, what is the one thing that happened that just changed you? I don't think it was one thing, but it all hit me at one moment. And I think that was when I was in solitary confinement. For 23 hours a day, I had to sit there and just think about how much of a disappointment I was to my mother, my family, and what I needed to do to get back on the right track. You know, when people see me coming, they see trouble. Like, how can I change that? So when I got out, I tried to do everything positive that I could possibly do. Enroll in school, get in school, try to get a job. Anything good that I could possibly do, that's what I was doing. I went to a huge, huge tournament, and then we come back. I'm just getting all this high praise. They like, man, you know, you averaged 30 points against some of the best players. And they was like, man, he's going pro. And that's when the thing just really start clicking. Like, you can have an opportunity to, you know, make a living playing basketball. Like, it's not too far of a dream. Like, you're not reaching out there too far. Like, this can really happen. And that's when I found my niche. You know, I knew I had a gift. I missed 2 years because I was in corrections. Like, my eligibility ran out, so I had to go to prep school. I needed like $5,200 to go to prep school. I went to my mom, I went to my grandmother. They had no money at the time. So there was a guy in the community selling drugs, and I asked him, I just said, you know, I need an opportunity to go to school to get out this environment. He was like, man, I'll help you out. I see you got a gift. I see that you're trying to stay away from these streets. Do this, and when you come back, man, look out for these kids. Come back and show them a better way. Till this day, you know, he just got out of, you know, federal prison. Never asked me for anything in return. He just told me that he's so proud of me. You know, people are, like, more inspired now. They feel like they can do anything. You know, be a doctor, they can be a lawyer, they can have a little adversity early on and still make it out. Because he did it. I know we can do it.
Whoa! Oh, monster slam dunk by Butler, and he's fouled.
The NBA is a sport, it's a game that I love, a game that put me on this platform and brought me unbelievable blessings. But at the same time, what are you going to use your platform for? What is your legacy going to be? What are people going to remember you for? Are they going to remember you for being just this basketball player? Or are they going to remember you for planting all the right seeds? I wanted to plant seeds. You know, we spoke at the Champions of Change at the White House, talking about the bridge between law enforcement and community. It was unbelievable. I mean, a kid that comes from the south side of Racine, inner city, with the background that I have, to be in the White House. Unbelievable. I told my mom, I called her. I said, look, we came a long way. I said, we came a long way. And I can just say hallelujah. She said hallelujah on the phone, hallelujah. I said, we came a long way.
Butler's forthcoming book, Tough Juice, is available for pre-order on Amazon.com. Our story was produced by Only a Games Karen Given. On Tuesday night, the New York Liberty, having established their best-ever regular season record, beat the Washington Mystics in the Eastern Conference semifinals. Then they doused the Indiana Fever in Game 1 of the conference finals the next night. That's the way it works in the WNBA postseason. The heart of the Liberty is tenacious defense, a hallmark of Coach of the Year Bill Laimbeer, who won 3 championships coaching the Detroit Shock before coming to New York. But at a first-round playoff Liberty game, fans were concerned with matters other than defense and three-pointers. The baggage team president Isaiah Thomas had brought to his job when he was appointed in May was still on Alison Durham's mind.
I don't agree with how he's still involved in the WNBA. I think it's disgusting. I have no other words. It's disgusting.
In 2007, Thomas, who'd been president of the New York Knicks as they tumbled into obscurity, lost a sexual harassment suit brought against him by an employee of Madison Square Garden. A jury awarded her $11.6 million. The Liberty declined to make Thomas or other front office personnel available for comment on this story, but it's a measure of how well the team has been playing that attendance, which had been off at the start of the season, has rebounded. Should Isaiah Thomas get credit for the team's success?
He definitely should. He's the president.
Mark Berman has been writing about Thomas and the Liberty for the New York Post.
You know, it's a bottom line business, and if you want to debate whether it's still appropriate that Isaiah Thomas is running a women's basketball team, you can. But if you want to debate, should Isaiah Thomas get any credit for the Liberty's historic season, I mean, to me, it's not even an issue.
Liberty players are inclined to celebrate everybody's contribution to their success, at least publicly, though Berman reports that the players had meetings at the beginning of the season to discuss Thomas's transgressions. Now their minds are on winning a championship.
This year, the entire organization worked together, and it seems like this has been a successful season for us.
That's Essence Carson, who's been with the Liberty since 2008. She was asked whether she and her teammates saw much of Isaiah Thomas.
We see him.
And that was that. Howard Migdahl, who's been writing about the NBA this season for Vice Sports, feels people who attribute the Liberty's recent achievements to Thomas fail to understand who built the team. He credits basketball operations director Kristen Bernert and coach Bill Laimbeer, who also worked together in Detroit.
The idea that you'd need someone to oversee a couple of people who have had great success and have worked hand in glove for the better part of a decade and a half here in the WNBA defies belief. Isaiah Thomas was working hard to just get up to speed on the league.
As Migdahl has noted, Thomas could hardly fail to understand the reaction he provokes in fans, even as the team over which he presides has flourished.
I mean, there was a remarkable moment. They honored Becky Hammon, the trailblazer and former Liberty star. And Isaiah, you know, in a very smart PR move, came out with Becky Hammon's parents. He still got booed just the same, but he had plausible deniability. He could claim that perhaps New York didn't like Becky Hammon's parents.
It has been suggested that the success of the Liberty this season may help Thomas put behind him fallout from the sexual harassment suit as well as his previous front office failures. It may be more realistic to think the team's performance will render Thomas irrelevant, as center Avery Worley seemed to suggest when she was recently asked to account for the Liberty's success.
It's all about us. Yeah, we focus on us and what we can do to improve our game and be a better team.
These days, they're better than they've ever been. That's indisputable. And for the Liberty's players and their coaches, sustaining that condition will remain much more important than who gets the credit, at least as long as there are still games to be played. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, one more opportunity to relish the wisdom of Yogi Berra. But first, I'm joined by Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports and Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Together, we will present three stories you should know. Craig and Rachel, welcome back.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
Craig, seeing as how we are about to embark on the most exciting part of the baseball season and your story is set in baseball, why don't you lead off?
Yes. On Wednesday night, Washington Nationals closer Jonathan Papelbon intentionally hit Orioles third baseman Manny Machado with a pitch because Machado had the temerity to do his job well. He hit a home run a couple of innings earlier, and under baseball's wonderful unwritten rules, that apparently requires a plunking. And this was a pretty serious one. It could have almost hit his head. The most beautiful thing about that, though, is the criticism of Jonathan Papelbon from within baseball was not about him throwing a 93-mile-per-hour fastball at someone's head. It's because he didn't throw it at his tuchus, or he didn't throw it at his ribs. That's apparently the big problem here. And I feel sometimes I'm the only person in the entire baseball omniverse who is concerned that maybe throwing balls intentionally at guys out of a sense of honor is something we should put back in the past. I get shouted down every single time I bring this up, but I'm going to continue shouting about it.
Rachel, what about you? Are bruised batsmen okay by you?
I think it depends on the reason you're doing the beaning. I mean, if someone hit a player on your team, you could make an argument, I would say, that these are part of the checks and balances of the game. But in terms of some other perceived slight, I think that's ridiculous and obviously quite dangerous.
The only problem I have really with pitchers throwing at hitters is they put their teammates at risk in later innings or subsequent games. And I think that's stupid because eventually it ends up in somebody really getting hurt. Still, I can't get too worked up about player damage in baseball compared to player damage in football and some of the other sports. I mean, there's really no comparison, right?
Oh, certainly not in frequency of injury and problems. I mean, the CTE issues in football are incredibly serious. In baseball, we don't see things like that very often. Now, clearly, if someone were to take one just wrong to the head, something seriously could happen. But this is more of a serious risk of something very unlikely as opposed to something like football, which everyone is almost destined to have some sort of brain injury at this point.
All right, we're going to move on to my story, which involves the Chicago Cubs. When they go to the playoffs, I hope they play well and lose, because if they were to win the World Series, which they have not done since 1908, their fans would no longer have a reason to feel special, as in especially burdened. I live in Boston. When the Red Sox finally won a World Series in 2004, what happened? They became just another team that sometimes wins and sometimes doesn't. And I think a lot of their fans just had more fun when they could gather each October for a chorus of lamentation. So I do not wish success on the Cubs.
Well, that's certainly the sentimental choice, I would say. And I'd say in that respect, I agree with you. Then again, I would argue that some Cubs fans might not even know the difference. You know, these are folks who come out in sunny weather. They're there to get a suntan. They don't always seem to care what's happening on the field, as evidenced by sellouts, despite pretty lousy records year after year.
And the fact that many of them are unconscious by about the seventh inning, historically.
Indeed. So I would say many of the folks in the bleachers might not really care either way.
Craig, what about you? Would you delight in the world champion Chicago Cubs?
Oh, I think I would for a little while, but I think I'm with you here on the dynamic of the fans, in that we'd have an opposite situation of Boston, because after the Red Sox finally won the World Series, you got a lot of grumbling from hardcore Red Sox fans about how now all these dilettantes are going to come out to the park because they're a winning team, and you're going to have the exact opposite problem in Chicago, because now all the dilettantes who just want to sunbathe in the bleachers are going to have to deal with serious baseball fans, mm-hmm. And it's just going to be ugly in Chicago.
Rachel, I understand that you have discovered renewed interest in boxing, albeit not at the heavyweight level.
Yes, that's true. College boxing at the varsity level was discontinued after the 1960 season by the NCAA. So after that, it exists only in club form. But in recent years, it's really seen a renewed interest, in part because the formation of a new governing body to oversee operations in college boxing. And what that's done is really invite more novices into the fold, more women, and attracted people who are interested in fitness and exercise primarily. Some of them don't even actually want to fight. So what we're seeing now is actually more than twice as many college boxing teams in the club form as existed in 1960 when the NCAA discontinued boxing as a varsity sport.
You know, I can see going into boxing and not really wanting to fight as sort of like, I just want to take batting practice. I don't really want to play in the game. I am reminded of a boxing story we did a long time ago, in the process of which I met a guy who was a state trooper training as a boxer, and he said, the better I get at boxing, the less likely it is that I'll ever have to draw my gun. That's the best argument I ever heard for that sport. Craig, what do you think?
I think this could be, and we've seen this also just in public health and gyms around the country, this could be the one way to save boxing in a certain way. I don't think it's worth saving as a competitive sport of two people fighting, but if you talk to fighters and you talk to trainers, so much of it is the science, so much of it is the fitness, so much of it is the discipline required. If it turns into a personal fitness regime and hitting the bags and maybe light level, no head hitting sparring, this actually could be a blessing in disguise, and that the beauty and science of boxing can be preserved even if the actual fighting is not.
My guests for this week's segment of Three Stories You Should Know have been Craig Calcaterra of NBC Sports and Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Measured by national championships, wins, and certainly by salary, Nick Saban is today's most successful college football coach. He has been celebrated, even idolized, by fans of the schools where he has coached, at least until he has left, and then he has been reviled. In Saban, The Making of a Coach, Monty Burke writes about the man to whom success has been so unsatisfying that after his team won the national championship, he called an old friend to ask, "Why don't I feel happy?" Monty Burke, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start with that phone call after LSU, coached by Nick Saban, won the 2003 national championship. What does that question, "Why don't I feel happy," tell you about Nick Saban?
I think it says everything about him. It's a cliche, but he's a man who enjoys the journey and not necessarily the destination. You know, he appears, when we watch him on television or we see him in a press conference, he appears to be a very unhappy man. He gets red-faced. He yells at his players. He is demeaning to reporters. But he is very happy, actually, when he is deeply involved in the minutiae of running a football program, whether that's managing his assistant coaches or his players or watching that 10th hour of recruiting tape. I mean, that is what really makes him very happy.
Saban's story starts perhaps with his father, who apparently was never satisfied with anything anybody was doing. At least that's the way I read it.
There's a caricature of the 1950s, 1960s father as being kind of overbearing and unrelenting. And in the words of Terry Saban, Nick's wife, you know, Big Nick, as he was called, was 100 times that. He never was satisfied with any effort his son gave. And his son was a good kid. He was a National Honor Society kid. He played sports. He did pretty much everything right, but he could never please his father. His father really demanded, I guess, an impossible perfection from his son. His father also happened to be his first football coach. And Nick Saban would throw a touchdown and he'd run over to the sideline and his father wouldn't say, "Congratulations," or "Good pass." He would say, "You know, that spiral is a little bit wobbly and your footwork was all messed up." And I think, to me, one of the more revealing quotes in the book is from one of Nick Saban's best childhood friends. And he said, you know, because of that pressure that his father put on him, you know, I really thought this kid was either going to go crazy or become a great success. And I think the reason that the latter happened is because he sort of learned how to adapt his behavior and not worry about, you know, how to please his father, how to reach that impossible perfection. He learned to embrace and love the steps taken in pursuit of that, which to a certain degree he's done on a bigger level everywhere he's coached. That's his sort of philosophy. That's what's now known as the process.
Nick Saban characterizes himself as a great recruiter rather than a great football strategist. Besides the history of coaching winners and getting guys into the National Football League, what has Nick Saban got that other college coaches lack when he goes to visit a potential recruit?
Believe it or not, it's a sort of warmth and genuineness. Again, this plays against the sort of public portrayal of this man, where he seems angry all the time. And yet when he shows up in these living rooms with these recruits and their families, he is warm, he is genial, he cracks jokes, but he's also all business. He goes in and says, "Here's my plan, here's our plan, and here's how you fit into it. And, you know, jump on the train or get run over by it later on down the road." Another thing I think that separates him is the homework he does on these recruits and their families. I mean, he talks to everybody, talks to their teammates, their coaches, their aunts, their uncles. One former assistant coach of Saban's told me that one time they went into a recruit's living room and he knew which brand of chewing gum this recruit chewed. So I think these recruits are impressed that this man who is so famous now has spent this much time paying attention to them.
Popular as Nick Saban has been at Michigan State and then at LSU and now at Alabama for the most part, he has not been highly regarded by a lot of coaches at other schools. Some of them have referred to him, in fact, as Satan rather than Saban. Or was that just sort of the kind of kidding that millionaire coaches like to run on each other?
These coaches who, you know, speak out against him to a certain degree are sick of being out-recruited by him and to a certain degree are sick of being whooped on the field by him. But I also think there's this sort of black cloud that comes along with Saban, and in large part because of his demeanor, but also because of how he's left different schools. So he's a little bit of an easy target sometimes for these other coaches. And his name, of course, lends itself to it. To that slur in particular.
Right. If his name was Nick Jones, they couldn't run that
right.
Satan thing
exactly.
On him. Absolutely. As we've mentioned, Nick Saban has moved around a fair amount. Has the attraction to leave one university for another or for a job in the NFL always been about money?
The money helps, but the money is almost a measuring stick. To Saban, the reasons that he's left have been, A, that they've been better opportunities for the most part, but B, probably more importantly, he feels underappreciated. He gets to a point where he's almost a victim of his own success, where the expectations of the fan base and the alumni become a little overbearing to him, and he starts to feel, you know, underappreciated. And I think that's usually what kind of gets the itch going again for him.
I need to get back to money again because this looms over the entire career of Nick Saban and, of course, the world of college football. You point out in the book, Saban makes roughly 70 times as much money each year as the governor of Alabama makes. No wonder Alabama fans expect them to go undefeated every year.
That's true. It's true. I mean, that's part of the vitriol that you hear after they lose. When they lose to Mississippi, you hear people calling for his head. And you know what? He's the highest paid coach in the country. He's expected not to lose, frankly. What's another interesting part about the money, too, is how much these college coaches can make for their universities. I mean, I had one Alabama trustee go on the record and tell me that he thought Nick Saban was perhaps way underpaid. Underpaid is what he said. And the reason for that is the amount of money that a good college program and a coach that coaches that good college program that wins national championships, how it can energize fans and alumni and give them, you know, when they're energized, what they do is they pull out their checkbooks.
In response to your book, Nick Saban has said, "I'm opposed to an unauthorized biography for anybody. I think there's some person that you don't even know trying to profit by your story or someone else's story." What is your response to that?
There is a utility to books like this. His autobiography, I think, will be great. And I actually say this in all sincerity. I can't wait to read it. However, to do it this way, too, to do a biography that done without the permission of its source, frankly, is done all the time in journalism. Journalism is not done by permission. But also, it serves its own purpose. There are many, many, many stories, both flattering and unflattering, in there that Nick Saban won't have in his own autobiography. He just can't. To me, one of the most illuminating quotes in the book comes from the president of Michigan State, when he talked about how every year they had to go to the Saban's house and kind of talk to them about, you know, different job offers that Nick may have had during the season, or you know, whether Nick wanted a raise. And, you know, he said to me, he said, "I just always wondered, why can't he be happy?" To a certain degree, that is the driving force behind Nick Saban, is this pursuit of the elusive state of happiness.
Monty Burke is the author of Saban, The Making of a Coach, and he joined me from NPR New York. Monty, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, Bill.
Yogi Berra died on Tuesday. He was 90 years old. The winner of 3 MVPs, Berra played on 10 World Series winners, and he's even better known for his yogiisms. You know the thing he said about when you come to a fork in the road, take it? You may think that fork is metaphorical. It isn't.
You say you're from Montclair. You know Highland Avenue?
Sure.
You know the fork in the road going up with the road up? There's a fork there.
Yeah.
Both of them lead up to Highland Avenue.
So take it.
Take it.
For a considerable time, Yogi Berra and I both lived in Montclair, New Jersey, which is why we could discuss that particular fork in the road during a conversation we had in 1998. Throughout that conversation, he called me Jim. I never corrected him because I'd no more have interrupted Yogi Berra than I'd have interrupted Casey Stengel. Instead, I introduced the interview by announcing that I was changing my name to Jim. Anyway, Yogi was in Boston to talk about a book of yogiisms that had just come out, and he was typically self-deprecating with regard to their origins.
I don't know why I say these things, though, Jim. That's the funny point about it. I knew about it. You know, we could be sitting at the table, you know, at home with the kids and having dinner, and one of them pop up and say, "Dad, you said another one." I didn't even know what I said, to tell you the truth.
Well, it's a really good thing there was somebody to record them in that case.
I know. They wrote down. My wife, she's probably got 150 of them. That's not in the book. She knows a lot of them.
I had the opportunity to speak with Yogi Berra in several other contexts. In only one of them did he appear to be tired of being Yogi Berra. That was in the visitor's dugout at Fenway Park in 1984 when he was managing the Yankees. It was a position he would not hold for long. At that point in Yankees owner George Steinbrenner's career, very few managers held that position for long. Anyway, a dozen writers had gathered around Berra in the dugout, each hoping for some magnificently twisted gem of syntax that nobody had heard before. To their dismay, Yogi answered their questions with rumbly mumbles, none of them memorable. But in the studio that day in 1998, he couldn't have been more accommodating. He seemed to especially enjoy talking about his family and the way his sons, two of whom became pro athletes, did it without the help of their illustrious father.
I said, "You want to play that bad? Play with your brothers. That's what we had to do when we were kids." Then my dad didn't believe in baseball. He come from the old country. He didn't know what baseball was. And And I had three other brothers that could have gone to play. My oldest brother was the best one of us all, and he didn't get a chance to go out and play. And I used to kid my dad. I said, "Dad, you know, if you let all your three sons play, you've been a millionaire." He said, "I'll blame your mother."
Yogi Berra, family man, Hall of Famer, sometime inadvertent contributor to the vernacular. We will not look upon his like again. Coming up on Only a Game, an ugly incident on a field in Hungary brings unexpected kindness and unwanted scrutiny to a Syrian refugee. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Swiss prosecutors have opened a criminal investigation of FIFA president Sepp Blatter. I know. I knew I couldn't even get through this without your saying that. Anyway,
it's official.
Criminal mismanagement has been cited. Innocent till proven guilty, but still shocked, right?
There has been like organized crime influence in almost all major sports down through history. FIFA is the only body that actually is organized crime.
They've cut out the middleman.
There is no middleman involved. Exactly.
Before that particular kerfuffle, FIFA confirmed this week that the 2022 World Cup will start on November 1st of that year, disappointing those who were looking forward to watching those soccer games in 120-degree temperatures.
Yeah, now they're going to look at those soccer games in 108-degree temperature. I mean, it's not like there's a lengthy fall with foliage in Qatar. I mean, it's the difference between, you know, broiling and parboiling.
On Tuesday, Robert Lewandowski, playing for Bayern Munich, scored 5 goals in 9 minutes. This happened in Germany's top soccer league against a perfectly legitimate opponent. What would a baseball player have to do to accomplish the equivalent of a soccer player knocking in 5 goals in 9 minutes?
Baseball, probably not, because there's no clock, which is what makes Lewandowski's thing so remarkable. I mean, baseball, I mean, the equivalent would be to hit 6 or 7 home runs in a game.
Yeah, exactly. You'd have to get up 11 times probably to do. What about a basketball player? 400 points, 100 rebounds?
Well, I think Wilt's already done that, so I think we're covered on the basketball parallels. Football, I have no idea.
Earlier this week, Charlie, you wrote a column for Grantland that explained why Broncos quarterback Peyton Manning should retire. What's up there?
He's falling apart, and there's an ESPN Magazine article out now that goes through what he has to do after every game, and it reads like something out of a horror story. This is a guy who can't untie his own shoes anymore.
Charlie, Yogi Berra died on Tuesday. Casey Stengel once said of him, "Mr. Berra is a very strange fellow of very remarkable abilities." I don't know if I could put it any better than that. Would you like to add something to it?
No, but I certainly would like to see a debate between Mr. Stengel and Mr. Berra, because the English language would never get up from the floor.
35-year-old attorney Corey Stackhouse has collected over 15,000 baseball cards, quite an impressive number. But the really fantastic thing about this collection is that the cards are all of the same player. And it's not Willie Mays or Mickey Mantle or Frank Robinson. It's former Expos infielder Tim Wallach. I guess this guy really likes Tim Wallach.
Either that or he really likes bad bubble gum.
That could be a stale bubblegum, even when it's fresh.
Who knows? I mean, people have odd enthusiasm. Some people skydive, you know, some people drive in demolition derbies, some people run for the Republican nomination for president, and some people collect Tim Wallach baseball cards. How could there possibly be that many Tim Wallach baseball cards?
Well, that's his goal. He wants to corner the market on them.
Well, how many different ones can some player have?
They don't have to be different. He just wants
them all.
Oh, I
see. He wants them all.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
I hope, you know what, because the guy seems a little greedy, I hope that there's somebody out there who won't sell it to him, and he gets all of the Tim Wallach baseball cards except one, and the guy who has the one holds him up for as much money as he can get.
Or says, "I'll trade it to you for a Ty Cobb."
Our Honus Wagner.
A fellow named Jesus Aparicio was injured in an automobile accident about 11 years ago. He was in a coma until just a few weeks ago when he woke up. And upon waking, he asked how Roger Federer, who was the number one men's tennis player in the world 11 years ago, was doing. And then he couldn't believe Federer had only dropped one spot in the world rankings. I wonder if Mr. Aparicio was curious about anything else.
That's amazing to me. I mean, that could be true, and that Federer has had the kind of career he had. But the idea that the guy would, like, wake up and the first thing he would think of when he's looking around is whether Roger Federer was still playing tennis. Why do I think this guy has 8,000 Tim Wallach baseball cards in his basement?
This week, Vladimir Klitschko postponed his October 24th bout against Tyson Fury, claiming a calf injury was to blame. But This announcement came after Tyson Fury crashed a Wednesday news conference dressed as Batman while being chased by the Joker. How could Mr. Klitschko go on after that sort of intimidation?
First of all, if your name is already Tyson Fury, why do you have to be dressed up like Batman?
That excellent question. Would anybody have to be insane to get into the ring with somebody named Tyson Fury?
Well, I mean, I think Tyson Fury would have to be insane to get into the ring with Vladimir Klitschko because Tyson Fury, for all the wonder of his name, doesn't fight really well.
And finally, Charlie, a Florida model recently tried to extort Florida Panthers forward Jahmyr Yager, with whom she spent some time. She threatened to sell photos documenting their time together if the 43-year-old NHL star didn't pay up. $2,000 she wanted. Why didn't that foolproof scheme work?
Because Jaromir Jagr is not married and doesn't particularly care about the photos. But I'd like to say, and apparently this woman is also dating another Czech hockey player at this point. But I'd like to say that, you know, $2,000? I mean, if all she has to do is find two Tim Wallach baseball cards and she can make more money than that.
If she finds the right guy to sell them.
Exactly. Well, we know who he is now.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at Grantland, and he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Jeff Gordon has made NASCAR's Chase for the Cup 11 of 12 times since the Cup Chase format was introduced back in 2004, but this will be Gordon's final go-round. In January, he announced that the 2015 NASCAR season would be his last as a full-time driver. Jeff Gordon, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much. Glad to be on.
Your place in this year's Chase for the Cup was not secure until the last qualifying race at Richmond. How disappointed would you have been if you had not earned one more shot at the title?
Yeah, that would have been disappointing. You know, I made the decision for this to be my final year, and knowing that, you know, last year we had a fantastic year and went all the way down towards the end of the season, even though we did win the championship, I felt pretty confident we could be competitive again this year. And it's been a struggle. It's been a challenge. And, you know, it was certainly a big relief to know that we were in the chase and we have a shot at the championship.
You know, in some sports, athletes on their farewell tours are shown preferential treatment, even during competition. But I gather other drivers were not pulling over and getting out of your way.
No, definitely not. Haven't seen any of that. Maybe that's yet to come, but that's definitely not what I'm seeing. I think that you got to earn everything in this sport, and even in my final season, heck, who knows, there might be some guys that still have some payback out there for me.
You and I first spoke in the late 90s, at which time you were racking up NASCAR wins and titles, but it seemed that a lot of NASCAR's fans had not really come around to accepting you the way they had many other NASCAR stars. Did you ever figure out why that was?
Well, the most popular guy in the sport that time was Dale Earnhardt Sr., and he was the guy that we were battling against for championships. I wasn't from North Carolina or the Southeast. I came from California. I came through the open wheel ranks. So I was a bit of an outsider when I got there. And I was probably young and arrogant as well. So it took many, many years to get the support that I certainly have today.
Yeah, I assume by now that it's time to say goodbye. You probably feel pretty well supported.
Oh, it's this year especially has been tremendous. To interact with the fans and see the signs that they've brought to the races. You know, we're going to miss you, and, you know, it's not going to be the same without you, and so on. It's been extremely gratifying and has put a big smile on my face.
When you and I spoke some time ago, NASCAR was growing faster than Jeff Gordon at the Daytona 500, but that growth slowed a little bit during the following decade. How are you feeling about NASCAR's future?
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people were impacted by everything that went on with the economy in 2008. So it's been a challenge. I think it's still an amazing sport, and we have a tremendous fan following. And I think the racing is still spectacular, and it's still great value for the sponsors. I'm looking forward to the future when I'm not behind the wheel of really looking at the sport from the outside. And I'll be doing some broadcasting next year for Fox, as well as be involved with Hendrick Motorsports on the business side of things. And I love the sport. I think it deserves to continue to grow.
You have said you're going to retire as a full-time driver. Does that mean that you will still pick and choose a few races to compete in?
I don't have any plans to do that, but I did want to leave that door open just in case.
What do you think you'll miss most about being on the NASCAR circuit full-time?
I don't know anything any different. I've been doing this for so long. What got me into racing and what I fell in love with from the beginning, the same thing that I love today, and it's just that effort that you and your team put together to get yourself to victory lane. You know, you get that checkered flag and celebrate that together as a team. It's just, it's hard to top that. And so I don't know if I'll ever be able to replace that, but I'm going to try to take that same approach into the TV booth or, you know, when I'm involved with Hendrick Motorsports behind the scenes. And then I'm really looking forward to spending more time with my young kids and spend more time with my wife away from the racetrack.
Last weekend at Chicagoland Speedway, you tied Ricky Rudd's record of 788 consecutive starts. And when you start this weekend's race at New Hampshire Motor Speedway, you're going to have broken that record. Your streak began in 1992. You're kind of like the Cal Ripken Jr. of the racing world.
Yeah, somebody called me the Iron Man the other day. I think it was actually Matt Kenseth. He was sort of smiling when he said it, but those are words that I never thought that would be associated with me. It's just, I always thought of myself as the young kid and being the veteran. It's just something that I never really pictured or thought about. So it's a great accomplishment. It's something I'm really proud of. You know, I think it speaks volumes about how passionate I am about the sport of racing and my commitment to it.
Jeff Gordon has won 92 NASCAR races, 4 Cup championships, and he has not missed a race since 1992. Jeff, thank you very much for speaking with me, and good luck this season and beyond.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.
In one sense, being knocked to the ground by Hungarian journalist Petra Laszlo may be the best thing that's happened to Osama Abdul-Mohsen in years. Days after that takedown, the Syrian refugee was getting a hero's welcome in Spain, and his son, Saeed, was hanging out with Real Madrid superstar Cristiano Ronaldo. Here's Ian Mount with that story.
When I arrive at his plain interior apartment in the industrial city of Getafe, just south of Madrid, Osama Abdul-Mohsen doesn't want to talk. We scheduled the interview days earlier, but Mohsen has had enough of the media circus that has sprung up around him.
Pues mira, por las mañanas la profesora.
In the mornings I have language classes, Mohsen tells me through an interpreter speaking Spanish. Then journalists, journalists, journalists. Indeed, in the days after Mohsen was filmed being tripped by a local camerawoman while fleeing a Hungarian refugee camp with his 7-year-old son Saeed in his arms, the video went viral. With that, Mohsen went from being an anonymous refugee to a media hero with a completely different set of concerns. But Mohsen's story started like that of many of the thousands of Syrians who've fled to Europe.
From Syria, we went to Turkey, where we stayed for 1.5 years, then to Greece by boat, then Macedonia, Serbia, Hungary, Austria, Germany.
Then the video was seen by millions, and social media filled in his life story. Mohsen had spent 2 decades coaching soccer in Syria, including a stint as the head coach of the Al Fatua team in the city of Deir Ezzor.
I was a coach in the first division in Syria. It was the best team in Syria.
That might be a slight exaggeration, but the team did win the league championship twice. That all stopped with the Syrian civil war. A lot of the team's players were killed, Mohsen says, but some are still playing.
Some went to Europe, some to Turkey, and very few stayed in Syria. Some ended up in Germany, Belgium, Saudi Arabia, Holland. My players and other coaches from Syria saw the video and they commented online that I was a coach, a good coach.
Once Mohsen's identity had been revealed, Spain's El Mundo newspaper profiled the Syrian coach. That story drew the attention of the head of the school division at Senafe, Spain's soccer coach training body. Within days, Mohsen had been offered a job at Senafe and free housing. As a long-term fan of nearby Real Madrid, Mohsen was intrigued.
I didn't know how Spain was or anything, but I always wanted to come to Spain with Real Madrid and everything. So when the offer came, I didn't think twice.
When he got to Spain, he discovered that the media circus had reached a new level of frenzy. Mohsen ran into scrums of reporters at the train stations in Barcelona and Madrid. Then, once he was settled in Getafe, Real Madrid's president invited the new refugee hero over for a photo op and to meet the team at the Bernabeu Stadium. The next day, 7-year-old Saeed got to run onto the field with Real superstar Cristiano Ronaldo for warm-ups before a game against Granada. Amidst all this excitement, Mohsen's Spanish studies haven't gone so well, he says, laughing along with Mohamed Labrousi, the Senafe student who's been working as his translator.
Gracias.
Gracias. Mola. Mola.
On dos.
Uno, dos.
Tres. Cinco.
Cinco.
Yeah.
Poco a poco, poco a poco.
Once he's got the language down, he'll start to coach locally. He plans to put in place the tactical scheme he developed over his years in Syria. At one level, it's based on something he admires about Real Madrid.
I like to move the ball a lot in the middle.
Mohsen's story seems like a social media fairy tale, but the happy ending isn't yet written. His wife and two other children are still in Turkey. And the day he met the Real Madrid squad, the PYD, Syrian Kurdish Party, accused him of being a member of the Al-Nusra Front, an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. It's an accusation he denies, and the charges against him have been discredited by the New York Times. But it's another question to face. As I leave, Mohsen apologizes, in English, for his original refusal to speak.
I'm sorry for the first time when you come. Okay. Anything you need, I ready.
Está cansado ya.
As he says this, Mohsen has the sunken eyes of someone who hasn't slept in, well, forever. Mohsen wants a normal life, but that might take a while. For Only a Game, this is Ian Mount in Getafe.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is James Trout. We had help this week from Sean Gannon, Zoe Sobel, Eilish O'Neill, Marquise Neal, and Bob Schaefer. Our intern is Alex Schroeder, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Our final word comes from NASCAR legend Jeff Gordon, who told me that he really enjoyed our first conversation since 1998.
That was great. We'll try not to make it so long for the next interview.
Easy there, Jeff. If I've learned anything in my 22 years as host of this program, it's that it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. I'm Bill Littlefield. I'll be back next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.